Jim Wilson is here to share a night of many sonnets with us. The sonnet is the most enduring of English poetic forms. Over the centuries, poets have used the sonnet to express their insights into love, impermanence, the ups and downs of human experience, and God. Some of these sonnets have become famous, and phrases from sonnets have entered into common English speech. We will spend a relaxed evening reading and contemplating some of the finely crafted jewels of the sonnet tradition. So, I give you Jim Wilson.
Thank you for coming tonight. The sonnet is about 800 years old in English, in European literature. It started out in Italy. I'm not exactly sure how old it is in English, but maybe closer to 600 years old, something like that. So, what I'm going to do tonight is read some of the sonnets that I particularly like. And since I write sonnets and I particularly like them, I'll put in a few of those. And then, if people have comments they want to make after each reading, or observations or discussions about the sonnet, then we can do that.
Can you actually explain what sonnet is?
Comes from the Italian sonetto, which means little song. So it was originally a song form. In English, the basic structure of the sonnet is that it has 10 syllables per line, and there are 14 lines. And what Shakespeare did to the sonnet was to divide the sonnet into three groups of four, and a closing couplet. So you had four, 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 and then two lines. All of his sonnets are written that way. There are other forms of sonnet that some of these will be in what is called a Petrarchan form, in which it begins with eight lines and concludes with six. The Italian sonnet was shaped that way. And there are other forms as well. Those are the two most important forms, the Petrarchan and the Shakespearean.
And the rhyme scheme?
The rhyme scheme for the Shakespearean sonnet is A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F, G, G. And I actually forget the rhyme scheme of the Petrarchan sonnet. Here, the first one I'm reading is, I think it's ABBA. The Petrarchan sonnet is much more difficult to write in English than the Shakespearean sonnet. The Italian language, almost all words end in O, end in a vowel, because of the pattern of inflection in the language. And that was even more true when the sonnet appeared. So it was relatively easy to rhyme. So the original rhyme scheme in Italian tended to be quite strict. When it moved over to the English language, which is much less inflected, it was harder to rhyme. What Shakespeare did is he developed a rhyme scheme that is very effective in English, but which is not as difficult as the Petrarchan.
Which language better?
Italian.
Petrarch. Mm-hmm. Oh, both. Okay.
Yeah. So this is a sonnet by by Charlotte Smith. I'm going to begin with a group of sonnets that I call Sonnet is Landscape. So what I'm going to do is group sonnets kind of topically. Charlotte Smith was 1749 to 1806. So that's her period. Huge vapors brood above the clifted shore. Night o'er the ocean settles, dark and mute, save where is heard the repercussive roar of drowsy billows on the rugged foot of rocks remote, or still more distant tone of seamen in their anchored bark that tell the watch relieved or one deep voice alone, singing the hour and bidding strike the bell. All is black shadow with a lucid line, marked by the light surf on the level sand, or where afar the ship lights faintly shine, like wandering fairy fires that oft on land mislead the pilgrim. Such the dubious ray that wavering reason lends in life's long darkling way. Comments or observations?
I kind of wanted to hear those last couple of lines.
See, what's really interesting to me about, and this is typical of her sonnets, is she'll lay this very vivid picture. This is very like Turner to me, this this oceanscape, you know, that's, you know, like all is dark shadow, you know, like huge vapors brood, you know, like that kind of imagery. And it seems like a seascape. And then at the very end, she throws in this curve all of a sudden you see the landscape as a symbol for something else. You know, like, would you like me to reread it?
Yes.
Huge vapors brood above the clifted shore. Night, or the ocean settles dark and mute, save where is heard the repercussive roar of drowsy billows on the rugged foot of rocks remote, or still more distant tone of seamen in the anchored bark that tell the watch relieved, or one deep voice alone singing the hour and bidding strike the bell. All is black shadow, but the lucid line marked by the light surf on the level sand, or where afar the ship lights faintly shine, like wandering fairy fires that oft on land mislead the pilgrim. Such the dubious ray that wavering reason lends in life's long darkling way. So I think it's brilliant. I really think it's a very, very powerful. She was among, she had a very difficult life. She had 12 children. She had an extremely stormy relationship with her husband. She ended up in debtor's prison at one time. You know, like, and it was in debtor's prison that she wrote her first book of poetry.
You mean that's from her husband? She ended up in debtor's prison?
Well, you know, like, I'm not familiar with English law at this time. I mean, I know there was debtor's prison, and I don't know the details of why she was put into prison, but he was also put into debtor's prison. You know, like, it was sort of a family thing. But, like I said, I haven't read a big biography of her, you know. But that first book of poetry, you know, when Shakespeare wrote his sonnets, and they had this huge impact, and then there was John Donne. And it was like those two powerful figures made it very difficult for people to write sonnets right after that. It was like, you know, you were always comparing what you did to these, you know, to these incredibly creative and beautiful works. And the sonnets sort of went into eclipse for about a century. I mean, there are a few, you know, now and then, you know, like, but it, you know, it did, it was not the rage it was during the Elizabethan and subsequent period, you know, like, it was Charlotte Smith who brought it back with sonnets like this. You know, she had that impact. You know, she wrote, you know, I mean, it seems that's a little, the language seems a little old, but she, you know, wrote in a very contemporary idiom, you know, like, and Wordsworth was strongly influenced by her. And she was, after her poetry was published, she was also a novelist, and she became very popular. And then she was eclipsed or just forgotten, you know, like, for quite a while. But in the last, I don't know, 50 or 60 years, there's been a renewed interest in her.
When did she live?
1749 to 1806.
How did you hear about them?
In an anthology of sonnets.
Usually you'd think of women back then, if they were known at all, it's because they came from aristocratic families and had the time, you know, the servants to do the work and the time to do things like that, to compose music or poetry.
Right.
The fact that she had 12 children, a tumultuous marriage, and wound up in debtor's prison where she wrote it. Just is amazing.
It is amazing.
She's
like
a woman.
I have no idea where she got the education, you know, where she, you know, got the background to craft lines like this. But the other thing that I find really interesting about her from a formal sense, the last line, that wavering reason lends in life's long darkling way, is 13 syllables. And you don't feel like it's too long. It doesn't feel when you read it or when you hear it that it's any longer. It's perfect. You know,
it's
like,
just beautiful.
Yeah.
It's astonishing.
Yeah.
And she wrote under her own name.
Yeah. Now, well, novelists, there's a history in England of woman novelists, you know, like, so that's not unusual. At her time, it was unusual to be a woman poet.
Nice.
I'm thinking of George Eliot.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's a good case, but, you know...
that's much later, though.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
So, what do you think of that turn? Such the dubious ray that wavering reason lends in life's long darkling way. All of a sudden, that huge landscape she picks is like, you know, it's like, what is it? She suddenly throws it all into this other dimension. You know, like.
That's an interesting thing about Shakespearean sonnets is you've got 12 lines of build-up, and then you've got two lines that kind of frequently carry the weight of the whole thing.
Right.
And if she didn't build up a really beautiful image like she did, those last lines wouldn't have the impact that they have.
That you, like, if you just said that to someone,
yeah.
You know, the reason only sheds a tiny light in our dark existence. I mean, you know,
I think that's
an interesting observation.
I think it's wonderful if you reflect on the poem and notice the development, starting off with a description of just the natural world there, the bluffs, you know, the billowing. Well, before we get to the billowing, we had the clouds.
Vapors brood.
And we proceed from that out to the sounds of the seamen going. And so we're drawn out to sea.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes from the very solid natural world to introduce the human being and then abstract it at the very end to an idea. It's a wonderful progression.
Yeah. Yeah, it really carries you right up to it. So thank you for pointing that out, because the last turn doesn't feel like an intrusion, even though it's a dramatic shift.
You didn't know it was coming, and all of a sudden it whacks you.
Right. One thing about Charlotte Smith that contextualizes this is she was one of many Brits who had very high hopes for the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and the French Revolution billed itself as the triumph of reason. They reformed the calendar, they made it rational. They were going to make the hour 100 minutes. You know, not 60. You know, like
the meter, didn't they?
And the meter was part of their whole program.
And addresses.
They actually sang hymns to reason. You know, like the revolutionaries would get together and they would sing hymns to reason. You know, that reason will guide us. And you know, the Enlightenment was really invested in that, and a lot of people in Britain were taken by that. I mean, they saw it from a British point of view with people like John Locke, you know, and David Hume. And then, you know, the excesses of the French Revolution were, you know, like, really took people like Edmund Burke, for example, became very conservative, pro-monarch, you know, like, I mean, he took this like a complete 180, you know, like, because it really horrified him, you know, like, and so I don't know exactly when she wrote this, but I thought of that when, you know, like when, you know, when she, specifically the role of reason, you know, like if she had invested all that energy and hope, you know, like that reason would triumph, you know, like, and then all of a sudden there's
also toward she, the end, she talks about the light.
Right, the fairy.
And how they're like the fairy lights that lead the pilgrim astray.
Stray.
And if the light represented reason, yes, then that could also tie in.
Yeah.
That, it turned out to be like an illusion.
That was how I heard it.
Yeah.
The reason is worthless.
Well, it can lead you astray. Yeah. It's a small thing.
That's and also, you know, life's long, darkling way. I mean, that's her own life, you know, was a reflection of that. You know, like, I mean, it wasn't all dark, but, you know, from day to day, she didn't know how she was going to make ends meet or, you know, what was going to happen or, you know, step
in jail. She was a contemporary of Blake's.
She was a contemporary of Blake's.
And there's that kind of disillusionment with the Enlightenment moving into the romantic immersion in nature that you see at the beginning of this poem. Mm-hmm.
On to the next one. Or, okay. Sonnet is landscape. You have to have William Wordsworth. So he was, you know, here with Wordsworth, he's often been called a pantheist. You know, like, and moving into nature is divine. You know, like, so I thought I would pick one of his most well-known ones, and it's called "Composed Upon Westminster Bridge." Earth has not anything to show more fair. Dull would he be of soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty. This city now doth like a garment wear the beauty of the morning, silent, bare. Ships, towers, domes, theaters, and temples lie, open unto the fields and to the sky, all bright and glittering in the smokeless air. Never did sun more beautifully seep in his first splendor valley, rock, or hill. Ne'er saw I, never felt a calm so deep. The river glideth at his own sweet will. Dear God, the very houses seem asleep, and all that mighty heart is lying still. Wordsworth wrote over 500 sonnets, which makes him one of the most prolific sonneteers in poetry. He was very prolific. His collected works are quite large.
Give us his dates to compare with.
1770 to 1580. 1850.
So he was a bit later than previous one.
So here the landscape is allowed to speak for itself more. Mm. You know, and what I've discovered in Western landscape poetry is the approach tends to be Charlotte Smith, that you paint a landscape and then you use that as a symbol. As a pointer, you know, like to something else. But there is in William Wordsworth those last lines, "Dear God, the very houses seem asleep, and all that mighty heart is lying still." There's a larger context. He places the landscape into a larger context. Any comments?
Very beautiful.
So he was on Westminster Bridge early one morning. Penned this sonnet, then and there.
when they come through, you can't ignore them.
Yeah, exactly. So So I've been heavily influenced by Chinese poetry as well as Japanese poetry. And Japanese landscape poetry tends to just paint the picture. It's almost like you're hearing someone describe the picture. So I wanted to try that perspective in the sonnet form. So I wrote this when I was living in Monterio, which would be like probably around 86 or 87. It's called Dawn. The ribbon road, slate gray, pre-dawn sky, caresses the edge of the forest night. The river, glass smooth, silent, fog shrouded, holds the featureless clouds on its surface. Moisture clings to my beard and empty space. My footsteps echo softly every place. Deep silence surrounding the sleeping leaves, no sound disturbing this still morning's dream. The river in the sky, in the clouds, the silence in the dream, in the sleep, the clouds in the river, in the dream, the sleep in the silence, in the sky. A chord of sun striking the river shore, into bluing sky, a hawk rides the wind.
Beautiful picture.
Yeah, I mean the influence of Wordsworth is clear, but I don't mind.
It's a different kind of picture.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he is flattered.
Nature has many aspects. Nature isn't always benign. You know, I mean, Charlotte Smith's landscape is kind of ambiguous. You know, like, I mean, you know, the brooding mists and all that. That kind of thing. There's a there's an atmosphere of anxiety in it. You know, like in 1986, the house I was living in Monterio was flooded up into the second story. You know, like, so I wrote this sonnet. It's called 10 Months After the Flood. You have left your mark on my heart in dreams. The sound of water stirs harsh memories. Sunlight glances off the quiet water. Shadows of the redwoods across the stream. 1,000 mayflies dance in rays of light, singing their silent song of dancing wings. A brief breeze breaking the afternoon heat. Shadows stir in expectation of night. I look upon the gentle river's face and wonder at its hidden graceless strength, for I have seen another time and place when the roaring waters displaced my home. Where once the raging Russian river ran, now, broom in hand, I sweep the river's dust. So sweeping the river's dust refers to the mud. Yeah, like the tons of mud. 2 years worth of sweeping mud.
But also has a really nice feeling of diminution of the power of the water, because it's now just turned to dust.
Right. Moving from landscape to still life, you know, like there was a poet by the name of Elizabeth Daryush, British. She lived from 1887 to 1977, so she had a long life.
Wow.
You know, like, I'm very fond of Elizabeth Daryush's poetry. You know, like, I think it's been unfairly neglected for I do know why. She tended to use a lot of Edwardianisms in her poem, and that became something people didn't really, you know, like. But she wrote this sonnet called Still Life. Through the open French window, the warm sun lights up the polished breakfast table, laid round a bowl of crimson roses for one, a service of Worcester porcelain, arrayed near it a melon, peaches, figs, small hot rolls in a napkin, fairy rack of toast, butter and ice, high silver coffee pot, and, heaped on a salver, the morning's post. She comes over the lawn, the young heiress, from her early walk in her garden wood, feeling that life's a table set to bless her delicate desires with all that's good, that even the unopened future lies like a love letter full of sweet surprise. When I read this, I wonder if there's a subtle undertone of implied social criticism, you know, like in it. You know, like I'm not sure. I don't really know enough about her, but I sort of picked up, you know, the young heiress gliding over the lawn and all the stuff has been laid out to her. I'm not sure, but I don't think.
Could you give us the last two lines again?
That even the unopened future lies like a love letter. Full of sweet surprise.
It seems very. There's a lot of strong air of domesticity in it.
Yes. Yeah. I'm probably reading into it.
Well, and contentment. I mean, there's just a happiness.
Yes. Yeah. So, sonnet as religious introspection. So, you know, what do the sonneteers say about God? Incidentally, you know, like one of the interesting things is after the sonnet moved first from Italy to France, I believe this is the progression, Italy to France, and then England. I'm not sure whether it moved from France to England first, but anyway, there was actually a lot of contact between Italy and England in those days. So. And then it moved to the Germanic area. And that's Spain, and then the Germanic area. Within maybe 100 to 150 years of its appearance in Italy. You know. And so here's an interesting question. What makes the sonnet so attractive? Why would people want to put their thoughts and their observations into this form? I mean, it's kind of an intriguing question, you know, like what was going on at that time that made it so compelling, you know, to people. John Donne,
1531 to 1731 to 1732 I think 1531 1532 1732 I don't 1732 1732 I'm early 15th century 15th century 1572 to 1631 that's right 1572 to 1631 might it be that it was the shortest form of poetry in its day, was it possible that it was that day's haiku, it was the shortest form of what they called a fixed form although
I don't know when the Sestina and the Villanelle, you know, started making their rounds, but I don't know enough about poetic history. But it was considered short, and interestingly enough, when it first appeared in Italy, some professors said that it was, oh, this is just a popular form. It's much too short to say anything profound. when it first made its appearance. But the Italians knew it came from a popular song form, you know, like, and given the class distinctions of that time, you know, like a university professor would have not responded positively to that origin, you know, like.
It was the Twitter of that time.
It was the Twitter of that time.
It was a tweet.
Tweet song. So John Donne wrote some really, really famous. So probably his most famous was one is "Death Be Not Proud." You know, like,
oh, yeah.
You know, like But but here's one of his religious sonnets. So. Oh, to vex me, contraries meet in one. Inconstancy unnaturally hath begot a constant habit, that, when I would not, I change in vows and in devotion. As humorous is my contrition, as my profane love, and as soon forgot, as riddingly distempered, cold and hot, as praying, as mute, as infinite, as none. I durst not view heaven yesterday, and today, in prayers and flattering speeches, I court God. Tomorrow I quake with true fear of his rod. So my devout fits come and go away, like a fantastic ague, save that here, those are my best days, when I shake with fear.
So. Wow.
What?
Is she quaking?
Is he quaking? Right. he shook. He didn't quake. He was an Anglican. He was an Anglican divine. That is an Anglican minister of some sort. You know, like, yeah.
He had his off days, didn't he?
I love this sonnet. It describes moods. I recognize these, you know. Things, so. Did you have one?
I was wondering about his influence on the Puritans.
He was not a Puritan. He converted to the Anglican faith from the Catholic faith. Okay. And his conversion to Anglicanism was troubled. It gave him a position in the church. He was, the reports are that he was extremely eloquent, you know, like very learned, and you know, if he spoke anything like the way he wrote, you know, like you can hear that people would come to listen to him, and they did, you know, like, but I think what vexed him was that his conversion had the look of opportunistic to it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that if he had stayed Catholic, you know,
he'd have been burned.
In the Britain of that day, yes. Very dangerous, yes. Or very limiting, mm-hmm. You know, at the least. You know, like,
But his sonnets, a lot of them have to do with struggling with his faith.
Yes.
I mean, I think he personally struggled a lot. Batter my heart, three.
Batter my heart, O three-person God. Yes. Yeah.
You know, break it down, make me more spiritual.
Yeah. I mean, it's even more. It's like break, blow, burn.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like it's maybe I should read that one. Should I read that one?
Sure. It's a great poem.
Break, blow.
Great program.
It's okay.
Not okay. I don't like it. There you go.
Yes.
Oh, I thought they'd have an index of first lines here. Oh, there they are. Batter my heart. It's not an index of first line, sorry. Well, I can't find it right now, sorry. But Donne was famous for these sections of his sonnets where all of a sudden, like, you'll have three strong syllables instead of the ba-bum, 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 you know, like, and one of the most famous is "In Batter My Heart, Three Person God," and then he goes, says, you know, "Break, blow, burn," you know, "Break, blow, burn my soul," you know, like, and you know, and he's asking God to, at the end, he says, to ravish him, you know, like, so that he will, so that his ego will not, you know, be so huge. So he really struggled, and this is another one, you know, that. Oh, to vex me, contraries meet in one. You know, like, here I am, the same person, in constantly, unnaturally hath begot a constant habit, that when I would not, I change in vows and in devotion. You know, like, so, yeah, I mean, I really identify with that. You know, like you. It's wonderful. Gerard Manley Hopkins, 1844 to 1889. He went the other way. He converted from Anglicanism to Catholicism. this one is called God's Grandeur. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, have trod, have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil. And where is man's smudge and shares man's smell? The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, oh, morning at the brown brink eastward springs. Because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with, bright wings. So he's not torn the way the way Dan is. Yeah, like this is someone who's really confident in their religious views. You know, like the first 8 lines are a depiction of this world in great difficulty. One of the reasons I wanted to read it, it felt resonant to me what's going on, you know, ecologically, you know, like in the world state, you know, like, and seems to have a resonance about that. And for him, his faith carries him past that, you know, and for all this, nature is never spent. You know, like, so there's this shift from the human to the world of nature, and it's in the world of nature that he sees the divine. You know, like in the sunset and the sunrise, you know, like all of a sudden he's able to perceive the presence. You know, like,
would you read that one again, please?
Sure. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, have trod, have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil. And where's man's smudge and shares man's smell? The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights of the black west went, oh, morning at the brown brink eastward springs. Because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with, bright wings. So even in the midst, isn't that right? It's not convincing if you're not already there. Like, but it's.
I don't know. I feel like I have no use for the Holy Ghost, but this is near to conversion.
Right.
I mean, it's really powerful.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I think is effective about a sonnet, it's not. In a sonnet, you don't have time to make like a theological statement. So, like, if he brings in explicitly the Holy Ghost, but you can resonate with that anyway as an image, like the other images in the poem. It's like you don't feel necessarily imposed upon, you know, like by that. see. Well, I think I'll move on to the love, the topic of love, because love sonnets, I mean, I would be willing to bet that that if you topically arranged all the sonnets ever written, that love sonnets would be like the big, the big bulk of sonnets. The two most read collections of sonnets in English literature are collections of love sonnets, and that's Shakespeare's sonnets, and Elizabeth Barrett Browning's sonnets from the Portuguese. Those have been in continuous print ever since they've been published, and phrases from those sonnets, how do I love thee, let me count the ways, all that reverberate in the language. The first love sonnet I like to read is actually the prelude to Romeo and Juliet. And the prelude to Romeo and Juliet is a sonnet. The sonnet form is sprinkled through the play, and it's bracketed by two sonnets. The opening and the closing are both a sonnet. So, two households, both alike in dignity, in fair Verona where we lay our scene, from ancient grudge break to new mutiny, where civil blood makes civil hands unclean. From forth the fatal loins of these two foes, a pair of star-crossed lovers take their life, whose misadventured piteous overthrows do with their death bury their parents' strife. The fearful passage of their death-marked love and the continuance of their parents' rage, which but their children's end naught could remove, is now the 2 hours traffic of our stage. The which, if you with patient ears attend, what here shall miss, our toil shall strive to mend. I think it's a marvel of compactness. He really lays out, he's telling everybody the whole story. And the last two lines is, but if you, if you want the details, if you want me to fill in, I'll do that. But I think it's remarkable, that he actually tells everybody, that Romeo and Juliet are going to die,
It was very kind, because otherwise it would have been rough.
It would have been kind of unbearable, yeah.
Elizabeth Barrett Browning, the Sonnets of the Portuguese, that came into my hand at a used book sale, and it had a different cover. I never would have bought it otherwise.
Yeah.
That wasn't into sonnets, and I devoured it.
Mm-hmm.
I would read it nightly for years.
Yeah.
When I was a teenager.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, she's next on the dock here. Sonnets from the Portuguese, number 37. My own beloved, who hast lifted me from this drear flat earth where I was thrown, and in betwixt the languid ringlets blown, a life breath to the forehead hopefully shines out again, as all the angels see. Before thy saving kiss, my own, who camest to me when the world was gone, and I who looked for only God found thee. I find thee, I am safe and strong and glad, as one who stands in dewless asphodel looks backward on the tedious time he had in the upper life. So I, with bosom swell, make witness here between the good and bad that love, as strong as death, retrieves as well. Very romantic. Very romantic. But I think the power of Browning's poem is she really believes in the redemptive power of love. She explicitly says, I who looked for God found thee. That's a very powerful statement.
Yeah.
You have to go? Okay.
Sure.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, any comments or observations? Yeah. So this is from Edmund Spenser. This is a collection of love poems he wrote called Amoretti. Both the Elizabeth Barrett Browning and the poem from Spenser speak to me of new love. You know, like, fair is my love when her fair golden hairs with the loose wind ye waving chance to mark. Fair when the rose in her red cheeks appears, or in her eyes the fire of love doth spark. Fair when her breast, like a rich laden bark, with precious merchandise she forth doth lay. Fair when that cloud of pride, which oft doth dark her goodly light, with smiles she drives away. But fair is she, when so she doth display the gate with pearls and rubies richly dight, through which her words so wise do make their way, to bear the message of her gentle sprite. The rest be works of nature's wonderment, but this the work of heart's astonishment. Dight incidentally means to adorn a dress. I'm a big fan of Amoretti. Christina Rossetti, 1830 to 1894. And she was a very popular poet in her time. So this poem, love is moving along in time a little bit, you know, like from the introduction, you know, like, I wish I could remember that first day, first hour, first moment of your meeting me. If bright or dim the season, it might be summer or winter for aught that I can say. So unrecorded did it slip away. So blind was I to see and to foresee, so dull to mark the budding of my tree that would not blossom for many a May. If only I could recollect it, such a day of days. I let it come and go as traceless as a thaw of bygone snow. It seemed to mean too little, meant so much. If only now I could recall that touch. First touch of hand in hand, did one but know. It's charming, you know. Like, I mean, sometimes don't you have that? You know, like you. So when was it? What was it that we did? You know, when we. You know, I think we were that. You know, like that kind of feeling. You all know Garrison Keillor, yeah. A lot of people don't know that he loves to write sonnets. So he was born in 1942, and he published a book called 77 Love Sonnets. Like, and so moving into the modern era, you made crusty bread rolls filled with chunks of brie, and minced garlic drizzled with olive oil, and baked them until the brie was bubbly, as we ate them lovingly, our legs coiled together under the table. And salmon with dill, and lemon with whole wheat couscous, baked with garlic and French ginger, and a hill of green beans and carrots roasted with honey and tofu. It was beautiful. The candles, the linen and silver, the sun shining down on our northern street, me with my hand on your leg, you, my lover, in your jeans and green t-shirt and beautiful bare feet. How simple life is. We buy a fish. We are fed. We sit close to each other. We talk. And then we go to bed. Very domestic, don't you? Doesn't that sound like a Garrison Keillor song?
Love with garlic.
Love with garlic. Oh, yeah. Moving along further in time, Shakespeare's sonnet number 73. That time of year thou mayst in me behold, when yellow leaves or none or few do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. In me thou seest the twilight of such day as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away, death's second self that seals up all in rest. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the deathbed whereon it must expire, consumed with that which it was nourished by. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, to love that well which thou must leave ere long. That is a famous sonnet, particularly that one line, bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang.
One of the things I really like about it is that yellow leaves or none or few, mm-hmm. so it's bright and there's nothing.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then there's...
Mm-hmm. But intense.
When yellow leaves or none or few do hang upon these boughs which shake against the cold,
yeah.
Bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. In Shakespeare's day, incidentally, there literally were bare ruined choirs dotting the landscape. You know, so his audience would have had that visual experience, because Henry, when he disestablished the monasteries, he didn't just kick the monks out, he, you know, like burned them down. So the landscape of England was dotted with these ruined monasteries.
Shakespeare, I think, was in his 30s when he wrote that.
Yeah.
So, wow. You know, you think of a man my age writing
something like that. I didn't realize that, but you're right. His sonnets were an early effort, weren't they? Wow. Huh. So he had the ability, even at that age, to sort of put himself in another character.
Amazing.
You know, like.
What number was that?
73. Yeah. So love leads to loss. You know, like love and loss are intimately connected. And this is a famous sonnet by Wordsworth on the theme of love and lost. Love and loss. Surprised by joy, impatient as the wind, I turn to share the transport. Oh, with whom but thee, deep buried in the silent tomb, that spot which no vicissitude can find. Love, faithful love, recalled thee to my mind. But how could I forget thee? Through what power, even for the least division of an hour, have I been so beguiled as to be blind to my most grievous loss? That thought's return was the worst pang that sorrow ever bore, save one only, when I stood forlorn, knowing my heart's best treasure was no more, that neither present time nor years unborn could to my sight that heavenly face restore. But it was, my understanding is that he wrote that on the death of his daughter. And Donne's Death Be Not Proud, I believe, was written on the death of his son. This is a sonnet I wrote on the theme of love and loss. I saw you last night, again, in a dream. We stood hand in hand by a forest stream that meandered gently to pine and pond. Rays of sunlight were sparkling in your hair, bright blue like the sky were your eyes so fair, and you smiled that smile of which I was so fond. Morning came, and I found myself in bed. I turned to face the clock and felt the dread of another ashen day without you. Steam patterns on the mirror as I shave, the sky slowly turning from night to dawn. Across the street, a neighbor starts his car. A dream of 7 years remains a dream. A dream of 7 hours lasts just one night.
Who wrote that?
Moi. So there's an expression that all meetings end in parting and all love ends in death or divorce. So this is a sonnet by William Baer from a book called Bocage and Other Sonnets. He's a contemporary. I can't remember. He's alive. I think he was born in 48. And it's called Letter of Resignation. Okay. Dear blank, after much deliberation, without qualm, scruple, or further delay, I hereby tender my formal resignation as your lover and future fiancé. The job provides too little satisfaction, too many hours of unneeded duress, a paucity of productive interaction, uncertain working conditions, and endless stress. Pay-wise, I'm undervalued and disenchanted. Advancement slow, the bonus is routine. My on-call overtime is taken for granted, and benefits are few and far between. This document, I'm hopeful, underscores my deep regret. I'm very truly yours. So, I just have a few more minutes. I'd like to read a few miscellaneous sonnets. You know, not on these big topics, but just on. This is one that Garrison Keillor wrote, and I wanted to read it because it's called "On the Opening of a New Bookstore." So, on the high hill above the river in St. Paul, against the advice of civil engineers, the Archbishop insisted his cathedral stand tall and stone gray, and so it has for 80 years. Back behind its magnificence, on drowsy streets of gabled houses, brick and stone and wood, are a thousand stories of the daily feats of courage that are love and parenthood. Each lighted window represents an enterprise by strangers whom I feel I ought to know, and so, in a bookstore with windows to the skies, I sit and read heroic tales of long ago. A cold fall day, and we are strangers, far apart, but in these books I find some secrets of your heart. Mm. Mm. Sweet, it's sweet. Mm. Yeah. This one is by a woman, her name is Kate Sherrod. I don't think she's in any relationship to the famous Sherrod in the news right now. But and she has a blog called Suppertime Sonnets. And she's made this commitment to write a sonnet before supper every day. So she, and she's close to successful, you know, like, so, and this is from her blog. It's called A Memorable Fancy. From recent plane trips, I have come to know just what our country looks like from on high. as seen through clouds so very far below, today a grand illusion in the sky caused dizziness. I lay back in my swing, inhaled my Chinese lilacs, and my gaze went upward. Truly, 'twas the strangest thing. Farmlands and fields and rivers through a haze of drifting water vapor did appear, as though my world had turned inside out, as though the antipodes had come so near I'd reach them if I just let go. About me, all seemed poised to let me go and float off to the skylands, however remote. Two more, and then we'll finish up. So I asked a question at the beginning about what's attractive about the sonnet, and Wordsworth actually wrote a sonnet about that. So it's so this is his sonnet about sonnets. Nuns fret not at their convent's narrow room, and hermits are contented with their cells, and students with their pensive citadels. Maids at the wheel, the weaver at his loom, sit blithe and happy. Bees that soar for bloom high at the highest peak of furnace fells will murmur by the hour in foxglove bells. In truth, the prison unto which we doom ourselves no prison is, and hence to me, in sundry moods, 'twas pastime to be bound within the sonnet's scanty plot of ground. Pleased if some souls, for such their needs must be, who have felt the weight of too much liberty, should find brief solace there, as I have found. So, I think a form like the sonnet gives people a sense of focus. You know, like it's like, you know, it focuses the mind. It's a tool for concentration. You know, like it creates context for concentration.
Did you bring a sonnet that you wrote that you liked?
Dionysus?
Oh, the Dionysus one? Mm. I did bring it. Oh, there it is. By popular demand, this one is called Constant Grace. It was on the morning the sun went down, on the night when I heard the angels sing. I climbed a stairway past the stars and found a sea of light beyond imagining. It wasn't a dream or a fantasy or a mere projection of my own mind. Waves of compassion were what I perceived, and the source that teaches us to be kind. Drumbeats of mercy pulsed upon the air. Forgiveness without end was everywhere. It was the cessation of all despair, the evaporation of fear and care. A voice softly whispered, "This is what I ceaselessly give. This is the world as it actually is." A voice softly whispered, "This is what I ceaselessly give. This is the world as it actually is." Oh, thank you. And I think I'll close. This is a sonnet I wrote yesterday. I posted it on my blog today. I have a blog. I have a poetry blog. It's not a sonnet blog. It's a poetry blog, if any of you are interested. And it's called On Old Age. So, after 60 years, one is less agile, and most everyone is younger than you. They tend to treat you as extra fragile, which is a good thing, because it's true.
Amen.
Time becomes more amorphous and less rushed. Was it 3 or perhaps 10 years ago? And so one speaks less, and one's tones are hushed, unsure, remote, hesitant, kind of slow. It is the time of life to go within, to become quiet, to escape the din, to break free of all of the commotion, to ride the ebb tide into the ocean. It is the time of sunset and return, when all the ties to this sad world are burned.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So that's my night of many sonnets. You know, like, do you have closing observations to make, or questions about any of the specific sonnets or sonnets in general?
The ones you read tonight, will you put those on your blog?
I only post my own poetry on my blog. It's
unless you're reviewing somebody else.
Unless I'm reviewing somebody else. Mm-hmm. But I have them all here, and if you want them, I can make a copy of them. I may have it in my computer. If that's something you would like,
I'll glance at that.
It would be easy.
Write down a couple first lines and Google.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing the evening with me, and I appreciate it. It was wonderful having you here, and I enjoyed reading them, and I hope you enjoyed listening to them. Thank you very much.